Welcome to this AAT podcast on employment status matters, where today I will discuss how to decide whether a worker can be engaged on a self-employed basis or whether he or she should be employed and included on the payroll with pay-as-you-earn operated and Class 1 national insurance contributions deducted. This has always been a top target of HMRC employer compliance officers, and therefore it is a very relevant issue for AAT members in practice who will be asked to give advice to employers, and also very relevant to a lot of AAT members working for employers. We are living in difficult times where businesses may be forced to make substantial savings, which may then mean cutting staffing levels, and which will inevitably mean for some that self-employed workers become a cheaper option. Why cheaper? Well, let's begin with the 12.8% Class 1 national insurance savings for the employer. And of course, we know that 12.8% is to become 13.8% next year. There will also be savings for some employers who will not have to pay employer pension contributions and who will not have to provide benefits that are enjoyed by their employees. Then, of course, there is more flexibility in the working hours, and it becomes easier to get rid of a self-employed person than it is to get rid of an employee. Well, that's good news. But of course, there may be some very bad news if our employer or our client gets it wrong and makes gross payments without deductions to one or more workers who are not really self-employed. That can prove to be very expensive when the engager, who is really the employer, has to foot the bill for the unpaid Class 1 national insurance contributions and at least some of the income tax that should have been deducted. The potential cost to any business could be very significant. Many AAT members will be familiar with my example of someone earning an amount equal to the weekly upper earnings limit of £844. A self-employed individual would pay only £2.40 a week Class 2 national insurance contributions, totaling £124.80, and Class 4 national insurance contributions of £3,052.80 on a profit of £43,888. That gives the total NICs for the self-employed of £3,177.60. What a contrast with the amount of NICs payable for an employee on the same earnings. Employees' primary and employers' secondary Class 1 NICs would total £9,083.88. The difference, or the loss to the Exchequer of nearly £6,000 for one employee in 1 year, is why this is a top HMRC target. And there is still the issue of the income tax that should have been deducted. Nowadays, with a demi-born adjustment for maybe some of the tax paid as a self-employed individual, the full tax will not have to be paid. But there will be an interest charge on the late payment, plus a penalty of between 15% and maybe 35%, or could it be 75%? Most of you will be aware that we have a new penalty regime which is meant to reward compliant employers and punish the defaulters. Whilst acknowledging the absence of employment rights for the self-employed worker, apart from holiday pay required by European law, many self-employed workers are in a win-win situation if they receive a higher rate of payment for the work and only pay Class 2 and Class 4 NICs. However, if HMRC successfully establishes that the worker was an employee all along, that employer has to pick up the tab, as in my example, for the pay-as-you-earn and Class 1 NICs that it failed to deduct. Most people accept this is a difficult issue, but that's why extra care is needed. We still have no statutory definition of an office or employment. Now I want to look at HMRC guidance. HMRC cannot provide us with a definitive answer as to what is an office or employment. From the guidance of the courts, we hear that it depends on the terms of the engagement, and the relationship between the parties to the contract? Is there a master-servant relationship, which would mean employment? Or is the relationship between an engager or principal and a supplier of services, which would mean self-employment, when the supplier is an individual? We have had guidance by fact sheets from HMRC in recent years. The ES for employment status, FS1, fact sheet 1, is aimed at the workers, and it asks, is your employment status right? It says your employment status is not a matter of choice. It is based on the terms and conditions of the agreement. And then it says that they are responsible for making sure it is correct, they being the engager or the employer. It then talks about your entitlement to benefits and employment rights, and says that the absence of rights and benefits may indicate self-employment, and the existence of rights and benefits suggest employment. Nothing new there, then. The ES, fact sheet 2, is for employers and contractors, and that asks, are your workers employed or self-employed for tax and national insurance contributions? It then says, for a definitive HMRC view, please use our Employment Status Indicator tool, ESI. It says we recommend that you use it whenever you need to check your workers' employment status. As advisors, we must now recognise this tool as an aid or something that may be used against our clients if we ignore it. We're told that provided that the information that you input into the ESI is an accurate account of the work carried out for a particular engagement, you can rely on the ESI outcome as HMRC's view of the status of that particular engagement. Therefore, I now say to you that we must not ignore it. Indeed, I will use it every time, although I do not always agree with the outcome. It does have some limitations, especially where the correct answer is not applicable, and ESI doesn't give us the option of saying that. I still want to encourage more AAT members to use HMRC's ESI tool. You can do it by going online at www.hmrc.gov.uk/calcs/esi.htm. You can find it on the homepage of the Revenues website quite easily. It does not ask for personal details, and the reference option is in case you start the test and have to leave it and go back to it within 7 days. It's not Big Brother watching us. If you use it, and it gives the right answer of self-employed, you should retain the printed version of the ESI result. Also, print out the inquiry details screen and keep that. This shows the engagement details and the replies to the questions ESI asked. HMRC says that we should retain a copy of the engagement contract, where applicable, and any other documentation or information you relied upon when completing the ESI. At the time of preparing this podcast, I'm also preparing for an HMRC inspection, where the client had already used ESI. I checked the status again on ESI, after clarifying some of the answers that the client had previously given. I can say that we're going into the meeting with HMRC with a degree of comfort, knowing that the HMRC officer should accept the ESI outcome, unless, of course, they can challenge any of the answers and information provided. I will just add that HMRC does say that ESI cannot be used for office holders, IR35 or agency workers, but please don't ignore it. Now I want to look at what the revenue calls special categories of workers. There are special rules which apply to some categories of workers, including divers and diving supervisors, something perhaps we won't have to deal with, office and other cleaners, the employment of a person by their spouse, the employment of a person by a relative in a private dwelling house. We have special rules for lecturers, teachers, instructors, entertainers, examiners, moderators and invigilators, returning officers, counting officers and their staff, and workers supplying services through intermediaries, known as IR35, and of course the managed services companies legislation. There is not enough time in one podcast to cover all of these special situations, some of which are quite complex, but I will touch on one or two of them for you. Workers in the TV and film industry are dealt with by two specialist units. Local Compliance Eastern England at Weardale House, Washington, is responsible for engages in film and video production and TV commercials, whilst Local Compliance Northwest and Midlands at Trinity Bridge House, Manchester, is responsible for BBC TV and radio, independent TV broadcasting, satellite and cable companies, and independent radio companies. They deal specifically with status inquiries for workers within the industry, and specialist guidance for workers in these industries is available in the form of a 28-page booklet that can be downloaded from the HMRC website. This guidance covers non-permanent, casual and freelance workers and the operation of PAYE and NICs. AIT members could find this relevant and might come across it in preparing accounts or tax returns for freelancers in any of these industries, some of whom, if they are performing artists, may be accepted as self-employed for income tax, and yet the engager may be required to deduct Class 1 NICs from the fees received, if those fees are similar to salary. One problem you may encounter is that you will not be able to get a P45 as such a worker. HMRC does not permit the employer or engager to give P45s to people who are self-employed, even though they have Class 1 NIC deductions. I know that IR35 is a big issue for many AAT members, although my advice is normally concentrated on the engager or the potential employer. The engagement or employment of individuals is the main HMRC status target, and workers of IR35 intermediaries should not be a problem for the engager or employer. My key message is always that the employment, engagement, procurement procedures should be in place to guarantee protection to the engager. IR35, introduced in 1999, switched responsibility for operating pay-as-you-earn and deducting Class 1 NICs from the payer or prospective employer to the intermediary, the IR35 limited company, or it could be a partnership. There must be a valid contract between the two companies or between the employer, engager and the partnership. A contract with the individual worker will not succeed. Another vital point is that all payments must be made to the IR35 company or partnership, the intermediary, and not to the individual worker. Next, I want to discuss non-executive directors within this special category. A non-executive director is an officer with a fiduciary responsibility, and the fees are chargeable to income tax as emoluments or employment income. The fees should be paid through payroll, with income tax and Class 1 NICs deducted. Having said that, I know that many non-executive directors have been accepted by HMRC as self-employed, perhaps because they have a number of non-executive posts and are treated as professional non-executive directors. The main problem is that NIC regulations define an employed earner as a person who is gainfully employed in the UK in an office or employment. And on that basis, Class 1 NICs should be deducted because a non-executive directorship is an office. Deduction should be made even if they are accepted as self-employed for income tax. Also, what about their travelling expenses? Non-executive directors may live a long way from the company's head office. Are they claiming home-to-work travel and subsistence expenses? Are they claiming for expensive hotel accommodation to attend the board meetings in London or one of the other major cities, perhaps? If they are, there may be other liabilities to settle with HMRC. One point to consider here is whether the non-executive director may be performing a dual role, that of non-executive director attending board meetings, and that as a consultant to the company. If we can establish that as the case, the two roles should be separated. The non-executive director role should be paid through a service agreement and through the payroll. The consultancy fees should be paid gross. I would still check that the consultancy arrangement will stand up as self-employment And of course, there would be the option of the consultancy fees being channeled through an IR35 company. It is a point to be careful of. Next, I want to look at employment status criteria. The employer or contractor must decide the correct status when the worker is first taken on or engaged. The fact that the worker has been self-employed before may not be decisive. It may not determine the issue. The terms of the specific engagement are crucial. Self-employed status does not automatically transfer from one contract to another. Workers can be self-employed under one contract for services, whilst being employed under another contract of service with different contractual terms and conditions. Frequently in the past, I used to demonstrate this to AAT members by saying, as an employee of PKF, standing up lecturing, I was an employee. But providing my services to the AAT, Tollies and others on a self-employed basis, I was doing the same work, but I was self-employed. The courts have developed a two-stage test for deciding the employment status of a worker. First, looking at the irreducible minimum of providing personal service and the existence of mutuality of obligation. The issue of personal service is where we see lots of questions about providing substitute workers, especially in an IR35 situation. Providing substitute workers, or at least being able to provide a substitute, where some decisions of the courts have indicated that it must therefore be self-employment when a substitute can be provided. The mutuality point is whether the employer is obliged to provide work and whether the worker is obliged to accept the work. The casual workers in the banqueting suite of the former Trust House Forte Hotel Group were held not to be employed earners because there was no mutuality of obligation. To the man in the street, that might seem a surprising result, where I'm sure they would think casual waitresses would be employees. AAT members would be familiar with the argument in the construction industry. The contractors are not obliged to provide work or pay self-employed subcontractors when bad weather closes the site or there just isn't any work. Quite a few cases have been decided in favour of the contractors on the argument of lack of mutuality of obligation. The second of the two-stage test generally applied by the courts is to look at other key factors which may determine the employment status of the worker. These key factors tended to be concentrated on by the revenue in the past, but in all fairness, the ESI test now does look at some of these factors and does take them into account. The control test has often been regarded as the most important and brings us back to the question as to whether there is a master-servant relationship. The higher the degree of control by the engager, the more likely it is that we have an employment. Conversely, the absence of any control or the lack of much control by the engager is more likely to lead to a decision of self-employment. Next, we have the integration test, sometimes called the part and parcel test, which seeks to establish if the worker has become part and parcel of the organisation and must therefore be an employee. A quote from one of the tax cases says, "The more integrated the person is, or the more work is an integral part of the business, the more likely he is to be considered an employee." This was Cassidy versus the Ministry of Health as long ago as 1951. But a more recent case, the case of the Ready Mix Concrete Company, suggested the test raised more questions than answers. But be warned, HMRC officers are asking workers when they interview them if they are part and parcel of the organisation. Yes, HMRC officers may actually go to the homes of workers and interview them and not tell the engager or employer that. The business or economic reality test can be important, asking if the worker is in business on his or her own account. If the answer is yes, the worker should be accepted as self-employed, providing their services through that business. So we should always look for evidence of the existence of a real business. the provision of all the necessary equipment, facilities, etc. by the engager, not by the worker, will be seen by HMRC as a pointer to employment. Again, conversely, the provision of significant equipment by the worker will point to self-employment, with small hand tools being ignored. It is difficult to draw a line as to when the provision of equipment adds up to self-employment and when it's insufficient to add up to self-employment. In the case of Hall versus Lorimer, Mr. Lorimer, who was a vision mixer in the film industry, did not provide any premises, any tools, any equipment or workshop. He did the work in the studios using their equipment. But he was held to be self-employed on the balance of all the facts. This was mainly because of the number of separate engagements that he had with different studios. So Lord Justice Mummery and his colleagues thought he was self-employed. HMRC's ESI appears to place a large emphasis on the taking of financial risk, which might include investment in financing equipment, materials, tools, vehicles, etc. Having to tender and compete for the work, payment on a fixed price basis, having a share of the profit, being exposed to the risk of making good, bad work at their own expense, and of bearing the additional costs of overruns, all point towards the risk of self-employment. This contrasts sharply with workers paid hourly or daily for all the hours or days worked. I don't want you to accept that hourly or daily rates means employment. I will argue that workers paid hourly or daily can still profit by completing the work early, and they may suffer loss by working longer to finish the task. Many only get paid when there is work available. What about the length and number of engagements? There is no statutory guidance on this, but in some industries, like the TV and film industry, HMRC use a 9-month rule for certain categories of workers. I've seen some status officers try to apply a 12-month rule. In other words, if a self-employed freelancer, consultant, etc., only works for one engager over a 12-month period, they must be an employee. But that's rubbish. Some freelancers, IT workers, and even CIS subcontractors may work for the same business for years. And if they're generally self-employed on day one of the contract, I would ask, what effect does time have on the contract? However, having said that, I'm always concerned about what I call employment creep. No, not that colleague you work with, but the way contractual arrangements might change without being noticed. Are there separate contracts of limited duration, say 6-month fixed contracts? How often are the contractual arrangements reviewed and checks made to confirm that the self-employed worker has not become an employee, has not been provided with employee rights and or benefits? This is a point that does need to be watched, because certainly HMRC officers will be looking at it, and maybe with the benefit of hindsight, they'll be able to argue for employment. Next, I want to look at contracts and the intentions of the parties. HMRC status inspectors will always ask to see the contract or engagement letter. Does one exist? Does it say what it should? Is it a contract for services pointing to self-employment? Or does it read like a contract of service or of employment? I've seen too many contracts that have been employment contracts where a few words have been changed because people are sometimes too lazy to get a proper contract drawn up. A contract can be written, verbal or implied, and all too often there's little or nothing in writing. But we must not overlook the less obvious contractual terms. This might be in the job advert, the purchase order, a letter or an email. HMRC compliance officers will ask for evidence of the contractual terms, so what will they find? The intentions of the parties might be decisive. I'm quoting now from Massey versus Crown Life Assurance, a 1998 case. It seems to me on the authorities that when it is a situation which is in doubt, it is open to the parties by agreement to stipulate what the legal situation between them shall be. If their relationship is ambiguous and is capable of being one or the other, then the parties can remove the ambiguity by the very agreement itself which they make with one another. In other words, It is always important to set out those intentions, to have something in writing, a contract or at least a form of engagement letter, that should reflect the terms of the contract and the agreement between the parties. A substitution clause may help to establish self-employment, but of course not if it's a sham, if it isn't real. A clause which says that the worker will make good in their own time any bad work will help. But again, we need proof to show that that clause is enforced. My advice is to fit the facts to the contract and exclude irrelevant terms. And please remember, the contract may be the clincher. So in summary, the operation of pay-as-you-earn and deduction of Class 1 NICs is not optional, although some workers and some employers would like it that way. Failure to operate pay-as-you-earn and deduct Class 1 NICs may prove very expensive to the employer. Businesses may prefer not to pay secondary Class 1 NICs, but they may end up paying them late and paying the workers' NICs and perhaps the income tax that they failed to deduct. Every individual worker has to be looked at when first engaged, whether already self-employed or not. IR35 limited companies need to be checked to ensure that the contract's with the company and that the payments are made to the company. Non-executive directors are being targeted by HMRC, and so are construction industry workers, where legislation is planned for the future to require pay-as-you-earn and NICs to be deducted from self-employed workers. This is a difficult area, and one that needs to be constantly monitored, remembering that the risk lies with the engager. I hope that you will have found this podcast useful. And again, I thank you for listening.